From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Monday, May 5th, in the chambers of the United States Supreme Court. In a 5-4 ruling, the court took the side of the town of Greece regarding sanctioned prayer at town meetings. For years, the town had welcomed a prayer to open town government meetings, and the vast majority of the prayers were Christian. Two women took their complaints to court, one an atheist, the other was Jewish. The court decided in that 5-4 decision, at least the majority did, that the women were not harmed by the town's practice. But Justice Kagan, writing the dissent, said that the problem was not prayer per se, but the favoritism shown to one religion. Kagan wrote that this country does not favor one religion over others, and so she thought the court had erred in its decision. Well, since that ruling, the town of Greece has promised to be inclusive. Tonight, an atheist will deliver the invocation at the meeting of the Greece Town Board. His name is Dan Courtney, and he's in studio with us for the hour. Dan, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also in studio is Ron Lindsay, the president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry. He's also an attorney and the author of the upcoming book, The Necessity of Secularism. Ron, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Dan, you're delivering the invocation tonight, and if you so vehemently disagreed with what the town was doing, why did you want to deliver an invocation at the town meeting?
Well, I think the important thing is, as a non-believer, as part of the 20% of our society who is non-religious, in fact, that we need to stand up and be heard at these town board meetings in society in general. So I think it's important for us to have that voice and to be part of the process.
And how did that – tell us how it came about that you ended up on the list to give the invocation.
Sure. It's actually a simple process. I sent an email to the chief of staff of Supervisor Rylick, who I understood to be the one that scheduled the invocations. And within a couple of days, I got a response as far as the date today, and here we are.
And couldn't the supervisor and the members of the town board say just another indication that they are inclusive?
Sure, they could say that. They've also made public statements in the past and as part of their argument before the Supreme Court that anyone can give the invocation. So to a certain extent, they're bound by their word in that they need to offer me an opportunity to provide this.
We've already seen on social media, online, people are dividing over this issue, as religion often tends to divide people in many ways to begin with. And we see people writing that this atheist giving an invocation calls Christian prayer divisive, and yet he's being welcomed. Isn't the town more tolerant than he is?
Well, I don't want to comment on that specifically, but certainly my message this evening is going to be a message that I think all Americans can rally around. And, you know, in this country, and specifically today, politics is so divisive, it's so polarized, that I think we have a duty as citizens to try to bring ourselves together, to try to provide an invocation in this case that everybody can stand behind. Everyone can find meaning in the invocation I'm going to be giving tonight. So I think that's very important.
What time tonight, Dan?
It's at 6 o'clock.
Okay. And I want to give a little bit of background here about what led up to this, because so often in these cases we hear a Supreme Court decision, but most Americans are not sifting through a majority opinion or a dissent. Most Americans are not listening to the arguments, et cetera. And there were some things that happened that I think offended some people, and I wonder if it offended you. Mm-hmm. I think it was it Justice Scalia who sort of wondered aloud that, well, what would an atheist even pray? Or I don't remember his wording, but he sort of belittled the notion that an atheist could even offer any kind of invocation or meditation, et cetera, reflection.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He asked that rhetorical question, what would, I don't know if it was atheist or non-believer, prayer sound like, and followed it with what would they invoke or who would they invoke?
Right.
And the simple fact that he asked that rhetorical question without having an idea apparently in mind of that even being possible really concerned me, because what that showed was that Justice Scalia, and it's not just Justice Scalia.
Of course, because people laughed when he said that, did they not?
You're absolutely
right.
So
he brought that up, and the whole courtroom laughs as if it's some ridiculous notion that a non-religious person might be able to have a reflection.
You're exactly right. And so what that says to me is that there's a huge blind spot in this country that Americans cannot even imagine, many Americans cannot even imagine a non-theistic invocation. And it's not something completely unique. They've been given before. And instead of invoking a deity, I'm simply going to be invoking an idea. Again, an idea that we as Americans can all agree upon and bringing us together instead of dividing us.
And so for those who wonder if your message would be exclusionary to those who are religious believers, you would say no.
Absolutely not. If you're American, this message will resound with you.
Now, Ron Lindsay is here as well, as I mentioned, the president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry. Why did the Center for Inquiry want to be here today?
We want to be here for a couple of reasons. One, we were very interested in the litigation itself. We filed a brief in the case. We were hoping that the Supreme Court would rule differently because we think that, in fact, it's not a good idea to have government-sanctioned invocations at town hall meetings or government meetings in general. That said, obviously, Supreme Court has ruled. We have to live within the parameters of that decision. And if we are going to have government-sponsored invocations, it's important they be as inclusive as possible. They represent the true diversity of America. And as Dan has pointed out, there's a substantial portion of the American population that is non-religious, and they should be represented at these meetings.
And that's where Justice Kagan's dissent, I think, even rubbed some non-believers the wrong way, where she said the problem wasn't a prayer per se, it's that it favored one religion. So she seemed to be saying, hey, prayer at town meetings, fine, just spread it around a little bit. Did you have any issue with that?
Yes. I mean, that was not the, I think, ideal wording I would have liked in a dissent. Here's a concern we have. It's great that the town is having Dan speak. We are hoping this is not just going to be a one-off occasion. And, you know, the town of Greece may be different than the town of Tupelo or what have you. The way the Supreme Court has left it is really left it up to the discretion of municipalities to a large extent, county boards or what have you, who they're going to invite. And there are going to be a lot of local municipalities, counties that are not going to be perhaps willing to have an atheist. That's going to create more problems. There are actually a number of right-wing Christian groups now that are insisting on more sectarian prayers. They want overtly Christian prayers, even more than they had before, because they said, well, look, the Supreme Court said we're not going to censor prayers. It's okay to have sectarian things. So we're concerned this actually is going to turn out to be a decision that leads to more divisiveness, which is not good.
Well, you're speaking beyond supposition there. You know, you mentioned Tupelo, but give our listeners a sense for, since that Supreme Court ruling on the Greecetown case a couple of months ago, have we seen specific cases where municipalities are moving toward overtly sectarian and proudly sectarian prayer?
There certainly have been efforts in that regard. I'm trying to remember right now. It might have been Roanoke, Virginia, if I'm mistaken. My apologies to Roanoke. But there was a town supervisor there who said, well, look, Supreme Court has said they're not going to review the prayers. They had made an effort. Apparently, I think the town council had passed some sort of resolution indicating they preferred non-sectarian prayers. So this supervisor said, we don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, we can have expressly Christian prayers, and we should go ahead and do that. So, yes, there are efforts underway. Again, depending on what city, state you're talking about, to actually have the prayers more sectarian in nature.
A question, I don't know if Dan can answer this on Twitter. Will the invocation be broadcast on WGMC like the rest of the meeting? I don't know the answer to that, Dan. I assume if the meeting's broadcast, then the invocation will be broadcast because all the previous invocations, as I understand it, have been.
Yeah, my understanding is invocation is actually part of the meeting,
yes.
But as far as what's broadcast, I don't know.
Okay. If you want to join the conversation, it's toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI right here in Rochester, 263-9994. Another question online, and we've been getting the questions. If you want to join the conversation online, you can do that as well, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. Mark wants to know, he's got your name wrong. Can he explain why he couldn't just walk out of town meetings before if he didn't like the invocations?
Sure. Actually, Justice Kagan in her dissent referenced this, and she says, what we come to in these meetings is not Christians or Muslims or Hindus or even non-believers, but we come as Americans. And she mentioned the fact that at the beginning of these meetings, when the invocation begins, very often the public is asked to bow their head or even on occasion to stand and participate in the invocation. If there's a non-believer and they don't bow their head, they don't stand, or if it's the person suggests they actually leave the room, what they're essentially doing is identifying themselves as not on the team. And this is the terminology that Justice Kagan used, was here you have the town board, and you're in front of the town board, and you're about to ask them for something that's important to you, to fix the potholes or whatever it is. And before you do that, you have to identify whether or not you're on the same religious team as every other member on the board and the person giving the invocation. That immediately sets you up at a disadvantage, and it's inherently coercive to the people that are participating.
If you're just joining us, you're hearing the voice of Dan Courtney. He is a local engineer who is giving an invocation tonight at the town of Greece. The first atheist to do it, is that, are you the first, Dan?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. What's the feedback been since people found out you were going to be doing this?
Well, you know, I've been pretty busy, so I haven't gotten a lot of feedback. I've been talking mostly with folks like Ron and other secular groups who have been very supportive of the process. So fortunately, it's been quite positive so far.
And it's interesting that the whole definition of labels, you could hear a debate from Neil deGrasse Tyson to Sam Harris to Peter Boghossian to others who disagree over the notion of whether atheist is a label that they even want to take, because to some degree people think it's pejorative or it's some sort of and we're going to be getting into this with Ron, because Ron's got a forthcoming book about secularism that I think touches on the notion of morality within a religious frame versus morality in general. But what do you think about the label? Does it bother you, or did any of your friends or neighbors say, "I did not know you were an atheist, Dan"?
No, I've been pretty open about it, and I've been involved in the atheist movement, if you would, for some time. So most people already know. But you can see it in news reports and interviews that the term, I mean, the headlines lead with "atheist will deliver invocation,"
right?
Specifically for its shock value, I think. I hope that by coming out as an atheist and other people coming out as atheists, that it will be essentially a non-issue going forward. People will be able to come out. They won't be discriminated against, and they'll be able to use the term just like anybody else uses a term.
Well, and let me ask Ron. I think it was Barney Frank last year, former congressman from Massachusetts, who came out as an atheist. And he of course, is gay, and I hope I'm remembering correctly, but I think he said something along the lines of, it was easier to come out as a gay congressman than it would have been to be an atheist.
You're absolutely correct, and I think his assessment was absolutely correct. Poll after poll, there have been a number of surveys about the extent of prejudice toward gay people versus atheist people versus Muslim, what have you. For example, the latest Gallup survey about, would you vote for this person for president if he were gay or African-American or atheist? Atheists, as has been the case for decades, are at the bottom. Roughly 40-45% of Americans would not vote for a qualified person merely because they're atheists. There's this very strong correlation in the minds of many people that being atheist means you're necessarily immoral.
And speaking of why there might be a pejorative sense of atheist, I don't know if our listeners are aware, but as my reading, and I just saw a piece in Washington Post on this, 8 states still have language on the book that prevents atheists from being elected to public office. Now, I also, as my understanding, and Ron's a lawyer, so he can help us with this, I think in the 1960s there was some sort of a determination that kind of language was not really applicable.
Exactly. It's Torcaso versus Watkins case, or the case out of Maryland. Maryland had a provision in the state constitution saying you had to affirm belief in a deity to hold any sort of public office. Supreme Court found that was unconstitutional. So I guess 2 things. One, yes, those laws are not enforceable if they were challenged. 2, though, is still very disturbing that they're on the books. I mean, can you imagine something on the books saying you couldn't hold public office because you're African American? I mean, people would be outraged, right? It would just be unacceptable. But for political reasons, and again, it shows the extent of animosity that still exists toward atheists, we have these laws that, again, they're not enforceable, but they're still out there.
Let me read the language on 2 of them. You referenced Maryland, which was the one that apparently came up in question in court. Here's the language that is still on the books in Maryland. Article 37, no religious test ought ever to be required as a qualification for any office or of profit or trust in this state other than a declaration of belief in the existence of God.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It starts off that it sounds like they're going to say, there's no religious test,
right,
as long as you are religious.
Right. Exactly. Right. But you can be any religion, but you have to have a belief in God.
Yes. I mean, which, consider the fact, what if you had, in Maryland, what if you had somebody who was this unbelievably we can debate whether altruism is definitionally possible anyway, but let's say for sake of argument, someone's very altruistic and they're charitable and they help children, et cetera, but they are a professed atheist. And then there's somebody who believes in a God that only, you know, some fringe religion that only honors people of certain race or wants women to be subjugated, et cetera, et cetera. But as long as they believe in that God, then they can run for that office.
Right. They can believe in Odin or some Aryan deity or whatever. Right.
There you go.
Right. Yeah.
Or Poseidon.
Poseidon.
Whatever you like. Right.
Right.
But they would be qualified in Maryland, but not the person who is charitable and giving and helpful, but is an atheist.
Exactly.
Arkansas. Here's the language in Arkansas. Article 19, Section 1. No person who denies the being of a God shall hold any office in the civil departments of this state, nor be competent to testify as a witness in any court. So you can't even hold office. You can't even testify as a witness because you cannot be credible.
Yeah. That's actually one thing that a lot of people don't realize, the extent of legal discrimination against atheists that continued well, actually, up into the 20th century. In fact, under the first Federal Judiciary Act, atheists could not testify in court. If you're familiar with de Tocqueville, he actually talks about, you know, attending a court session in New York, and there was an atheist who wanted to testify, and the judge said, no way. You're not going to be allowed to testify. You don't believe in God. Your testimony is inherently incredible. And that was essentially the end of the case. As I said, those prohibitions actually continued legally up into the 20th century. Again, that's something now that could not be enforced. So we've made progress, but still just this idea that we even have laws like that that haven't been removed from the statutory books is discouraging.
It is bizarre. Do you get the sense, and we've talked about Barney Frank, but I don't know how many openly atheist members of Congress are. I imagine there's one or two at most. I mean, I imagine there's more atheists in Congress, but I don't know how out they are.
I'm not sure there's anyone who's expressly out. Pete Stark came out, but then, of course, he was retiring. And, I mean, this is the sad political reality. I'm sure, you know, just given the percentage of non-believers in the American population, there are probably at least a dozen to two dozen members of Congress who are non-believers, whether they're agnostics, atheists, or what have you. The reality is it could be political death for them if they came out as an atheist. Certainly would make their campaigns a lot harder. And as a politician, who wants a more difficult campaign, right? We actually do lobbying. CFI does lobbying. We have contacts with various members of Congress. You get the sense, you know, there are a number of them who are certainly not strongly religious. They may not say they're atheists, but they're not going to be very open about it for political reasons.
Well, I don't know if I'm speaking out of school, but I'll ask you. And again, Ron Lindsay is with the Center for Inquiry, and you talk about working with members of Congress. Have you had conversations privately where someone says, I can't talk about this publicly? And do you encourage them? Would you like to see more members of Congress who are willing?
I have not had that conversation. Okay. Our director of lobbying, Michael Dodor, other members in the secular movement have had those conversations. I'd prefer that people be open, because I think, you know, one reason the prejudice against atheists exists is because people actually don't think they know atheists. The fact is, probably a lot of their family members, friends, colleagues at work are atheists, but because there's such a reluctance to come out because of the repercussions, people think, oh, there's this discrete minority out there. I don't know anyone like that. All my friends are good people. They can't be atheists. Same thing with politicians. They think, oh, well, you know, all the politicians profess belief in God, whatever. If we had more people come out, and I think that would really be the turning point for atheists, agnostics in this country, if we had a significant number of politicians come out and just say, look, I'm not a believer. You know, my views remain the same. You know, I still support position X, Y, Z. My religious views have nothing to do with it. That would be a real turning point. What we need to have happen is something that similar to what happened to the gay movement. You know, people started coming out, and that had a huge impact, I think, on the perceptions of gays. And we need to reach that point with atheists as well.
We'd love to hear from our listeners. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Maybe we'll pose the kind of the question this way. If you're a person of faith, are you comfortable voting for non-believers? And if so, okay, tell us about it. If not, we'd like to hear why not. And, you know, I understand some listeners might think we're taking a brickbat to all religion, and that's certainly not the case here. I mean, I know plenty of people. I spoke to someone right before I came on the show who said, I am a practicing Catholic. I'm so glad to see Dan Courtney going to give this invocation tonight. I disagreed with the ruling, and, you know, it's not a monolith. Religion is not a monolith that seeks to punish or exclude people all the time, but we're still a ways away, I think, from being able to feel comfortable with non-believers in office, which says some strange things, I think.
It does. It's fair enough, yeah. And I do want to emphasize, yeah, the Center for Inquiry, sometimes we're portrayed as a militantly atheist organization, which is simply a mischaracterization. We're an organization that believes strongly in freedom of conscience for everyone. We work with religious groups when we do lobbying. We have to join coalitions, obviously, to get things done. And there are many religious groups that are open-minded and willing to work with non-believers.
This is Will in Greece. Thanks for calling, Will. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. How are you and all your guests? Listen, I'm in Greece, and I actually have a very basic question, which no one has ever answered other than the Supreme Court did say it's custom. But why, in fact, do politicians pray before meetings? Are they looking for divine intervention in their decisions? Because if that's the case, I think you can see the fallacy of why religion is totally unapplicable to political proceedings.
It's an interesting question.
It's kind of blasphemy, as a matter of fact. It demeans religion, especially here in Greece, but in Congress, of having religion injected into decisions they make, when in fact they all make their decisions behind closed doors, and who knows if it benefits the public or not.
Well, and Will,
that's
my
accusation anyway.
Yeah, but Will, I think they would tell you that they are trying to be humble and trying to indicate humility before making important decisions is and asking for some kind of divine guidance so that they keep in mind that they are not the gods of the people, et cetera. I think that's the language they would use to tell you that they feel that it's about humility and trying to offer some deference.
Well, again, I don't see that humility in reality, and I don't see divine intervention in the reality of how Congress or the town board of Greece conducts their proceedings.
Thanks for
so
the call.
That's my question. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks for the call. Will, what do you think, Dan?
Yeah, well, I think that I don't want to get into why people want to pray, but obviously some believe that it's important for them to derive some assurance before conducting the town's business. And there's no problem with that. I have no objection to the town board members praying if that gives them some comfort and guidance before they rule on important issues. The problem comes in when the town endorses a specific prayer giver by giving them a podium with the town seal in front of the public during the meeting itself. So, again, nobody's against the idea that the town board members or the supervisor can pray. They can certainly do that. It's just that connection between church and state that ends up being a problem.
Yeah, I don't think I ever understood the argument that says, well, now, if the court had ruled the other way, those people couldn't pray.
Of course, no, of course they could pray, yeah.
I can pray right now if I like.
Sure.
And Dan may be meditating as I talk right now. Who knows? Ron may be praying as we speak. I mean, prayer is an amazing thing. Let's get Ruth. Come on, Ruth. Thanks for calling Connections.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment, which is that when you talk about atheism equated to immorality, I think it's ironic that most of the wars in the world are fought over religion and among people who think that their religion is more important or more moral or better than someone else's religion. So when you talk about immorality, I would see more of it in the place of religion and religious wars rather than people who don't espouse a particular religion.
Thanks for calling, Ruth. Ron, you want to respond?
Sure. I would agree to a certain extent. I mean, religion certainly does tend to cause divisiveness because certainly for those who are very strong in their beliefs, fundamentalist beliefs, they think they have the word. And if they have the word from God, that necessarily implies that people who disagree with them are incorrect and maybe incorrect about very serious issues. And that has led to, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of bloody conflicts throughout history. We're witnessing right now, of course, in the Middle East conflict between the the ISIS group, the Sunni fundamentalists, and the Shiites in Iraq over issues that to many people seem maybe a little obscure or not that relevant, but they're relevant for those people because it's critical to their religious beliefs. The only thing I would add, I would say, is it's not just religion. It's actually a dogmatic mindset that can lead to fanaticism as well. So we have to be careful to just say that it's religion that causes these horrible, bloody, sanguinary conflicts. You can have ideological conflicts. Communists, for example, who obviously carried out a number of series of wars, a merger of their own people, couldn't really call them religious. But it's the dogmatic mindset. I think it's the mindset that refuses to base policies on evidence, that refuses to understand that others may have a different viewpoint. That's what we have to be concerned about.
Yeah, I think that is certainly well said. And I appreciate Ron sort of stepping in and grabbing it. But Ruth, I think I appreciate the call and the sentiment. We're a little late for a break, but maybe I can grab one more quick call before we do that. Let's grab Gary if we could. Gary, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being able to speak here. I wanted to address the issue of being atheist, but atheism and morality. Because someone said that they... You know, and I believe it's true that people think in terms of, a politician, isn't moral if he doesn't have a God to answer to. But if you think about morality, and even on the basic level, to do something good because you're being watched by your parent or by some authority figure, aka God, is a lower form of morality than one that does well because they know it's the right thing to do without any supervision. So the person who is more, who does not believe that there's a watchdog watching over everything you do but does the right thing, is actually exhibiting a higher level of moral development than those that believe in God that's watching us.
I think that's an interesting point, and I think if there is an omniscient God, he sees through Pascal's wager anyway, for the farce that it probably is. I mean, if you believe in an omniscient God, Pascal's wager is getting you nowhere anyway to that point. What do you? I'll ask Dan, what do you think, Dan?
Yeah, let me just address that real quick. And you mentioned, Evan, in passing, Sam Harris. And Sam Harris's idea of what grounds our morality is the idea of well-being. Human well-being is the ground of morality. And I believe that's correct. The problem is, and this is why it's not necessarily just religious doctrine that's a problem, if you believe that comporting with a specific doctrine is itself equal to morality, that's when we end up getting into a problem. For example, Stalin, an early communist Soviet Union, he essentially set the rules, and what he said in comporting with his rules for a communist state was equated with morality, with being good. So if it is comporting with that document or that doctrine that's equated with morality, that's when you end up with the problems. But as an atheist, as a humanist, if we believe that it's actually human well-being and increasing human well-being that is moral, then I think we have common ground that we can work from. And I think, in fact, most people actually work with that common understanding that morality has to do with human well-being.
Yeah, the book he's talking about, if you're interested, Sam Harris wrote a book called The Moral Landscape, in which he tries to apply a scientific standard for morality and asks if science can sort of set those kind of standards. And that sparked all kinds of debate, even within the non-believing community, which I think is a really fascinating part of that, that even that part of the discussion is not monolithic. But, I think it's important, and it's bizarre to have to say it, but atheist does not equate to narcissist or nihilist, and that's part of the slur. Some atheists are nihilists or narcissists, but some Some believers are too, I would think so. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to come right back. Our guest for the hour, Dan Courtney, who is delivering the invocation tonight for the Town of Greece meeting, the first atheist to do so. And Ron Lindsay, the president and CEO for the Center for Inquiry, who is also the author of the upcoming book, The Necessity of Secularism. We've been talking about this notion of morality within a religious framework or not. Among many other things, Ron touches on that on his book. We're going to hit that next as we continue on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up Wednesday on The Next Connections, Archie is dead. The comic book character will die in an upcoming storyline after he takes a bullet intended for his gay friend. In the midst of Pride Week, we ask if this shows more societal acceptance or is it a cheap play for attention? Then we dive into Hairspray and discuss bigotry in American society. It's all coming up Wednesday on The Next Connections.
China has an air pollution problem, and it is not just about the breathing.
There is the physical side, you feel it, but then for a lot of people, it's also, I think, psychological. Just being in a gray, you know, polluted environment, you feel somewhat suppressed.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We used to be China. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6:30.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Ron Lindsay's book is called The Necessity of Secularism and will be available when, Ron?
It's released December 2nd. It'll be available for pre-order on Amazon probably a couple weeks before that.
All right. I've had a chance to see an advanced copy, and no, I'm not sharing it, but I can tell you that one of the things that Ron does is examine that notion of secular, of morality through that lens or not. And you focused quite a bit on the notion of physician-assisted dying for the terminally ill. Why that issue in particular?
Because I want to illustrate one of the here's in a nutshell the thesis of the book. We live in a democracy. In a democracy, we want our citizens to discuss public policy, to debate public policy with each other. There's one clear prerequisite for that democratic discourse to be successful, and that is people have to be able to understand and evaluate the reasons that their fellow citizens are offering for the policies. If religion, religious doctrines, religious precepts are invoked as the justification for policy positions, then essentially you're cutting short that conversation. Because unless the people who you're talking to share your religious beliefs, it's a conversation stopper, right? Because they're not going to embrace what you say. You're basing things on religious doctrine. So if we're to have a meaningful and productive exchange with each other, we need to use the language that's common to all of us, which is the language of secularism. Now, the counter to that is that, well, some public policy necessarily has moral implications. And if it has moral implications, how can you avoid bringing religion into it? Again, there's this notion that religion is necessarily tied to morality. So I wanted to pick one topic where there have been religious arguments offered and show that you can have a meaningful debate on both sides, and I present both sides of the argument on assisted dying, without invoking religion at all. And in fact, based on my analysis, if you bring religion in, it really just skews the conversation. So that's why I picked that topic.
I remember being in church as a kid with another family sitting nearby, and they had the matriarch of their family was dying. And I think anybody can relate to that. I mean, unfortunately, we all go through it at some point, losing a parent, losing a sibling, et cetera. And they were holding so hard and fast to any method of extending life for someone who I think she was in her 80s. And even as a kid, I was confused because we always were taught about heaven and eternity and the glory of the afterlife. And I wondered why someone who ostensibly believed that would hold so steadfastly to extending life on this earth, especially that involved pain, discomfort, a long death. What, What do you think?
Well, there are a variety of different reasons for that. One is, among some believers, they think their life is not really their own. Their life is a gift from God, and it's up to God to decide when to take that life or not, and therefore they can't do anything to try to accelerate that process. Even some people still oppose withdrawal of life-saving treatment, although most churches now accept that. Mm-hmm. And it just, I think there is still some sense, you know, people say they believe in an afterlife. I'm sure they're sincere when they say that, but probably there's some doubt about whether that's the case or not, and they want to, you know, cling to life as long as possible. And it also, but that whole debate, I think, shows one of the problems of relying on religious precepts as your basis for making decisions, because they tend to be inflexible. Because, you know, there's a directive from the church you had go to or the mosque or what have you, and it's laid down as an absolute rule. And it's a little reflection on, well, what's the rationale behind that rule, right? Look, I mean, everyone agrees that killing someone is a horrible thing, right? I mean, it's like the worst thing you could do to someone. So naturally, we have to have a society in which we prohibit killing. No one questions that. You don't need the Ten Commandments to realize that, right? Every civilized society has had that prohibition. But there could be some circumstances in which life for a person, a terminally ill person who's going to be dying within a few months, has become so painful and so degrading that that person himself or herself wants to hasten the process. In that situation, does our rationale against killing actually apply? I would say no. I mean, let's think through that. Here we have a person who, again, wants to accelerate the process. We're assuming they're competent. They're not being pressured. There's no reason not to assist that person. Actually, you're doing that person. You're showing compassion toward that person.
We're talking to Ryan Lindsay, who is the president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry, who is the author of the upcoming book, The Necessity of Secularism, which is not available for order yet, but will be and out before the end of the year. And Dan Courtney is in studio, who is giving an invocation tonight at the Greasetown board meeting. To our knowledge, the first atheist to do so. And if you want to join the conversation, you can do so. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We've talked about a lot of different things when it comes to the framework of these discussions. And so often, Ron, it goes back to, well, this country was founded on XYZ. You addressed a lot of that in your book. And I don't seek to belittle anyone who looks at the framers and founders with respect and admiration and wants to understand what their mindset was. Do you get the sense, though, that a lot of the people having those discussions haven't studied at a scholarly level what was actually done and said?
Yes, that's the short answer. One of the arguments you hear a lot of the times is that this is a Christian nation. And the arguments that are or the evidence, I'll put that maybe in scare quotes, that's often offered for that position is, well, you know, most of the country was Christian, which is true. I mean, in a generic sense, it was Protestant Christian, although the difference is then between Protestants probably more acute than they are now because, you know, Baptists had very strident arguments with Episcopalians and what have you. But general sense, yeah, overwhelming majority of the population are Christian. Many of the founders were Christian, although many of the key founders, such as Adams, Washington, Franklin were deist. Jefferson, of course, was very tepid deist. But it really kind of misses the point to talk about, well, gee, you know, these particular founders were Christian and maybe this one was a deist or whatever, because that assumes that they necessarily wanted to translate their religious beliefs into the structure of government. And quite to the contrary, the evidence indicates that the framers, because of all the history of persecution and religious turmoil in Europe and in the early colonies, wanted to found a secular government, a government that clearly kept its hands out of religion and kept religion's nose out of government. And if you look at the debates, for example, in Congress about the Establishment Clause, I think it's irrefutable that what they wound up with was a decision that let's keep religion as separate from government as possible.
We had Supervisor Bill Reilich of the Town of Greece on this program a couple of months ago after that decision was made. And he says that his view of the founders and the framers is not that. We often hear that separation of church and state means keeping religion out of government. He said that's backwards. It's keeping government out of religion, but religion is always going to be part of government, especially in this country. Do you think his interpretation is flawed?
Yes. I mean, he is true. I mean, it is correct that the framers also wanted to keep government out of religion because they thought – essentially this goes back, not to go into too much philosophical detail, but John Locke was the theorist that influenced many of the framers, and his view was that in his arguments he made for religious toleration, he said the business of government is the business of this world. The business of religion is otherworldly concerns. Government simply is not competent to address religious matters. And likewise, religious authorities have no business telling the government what to do. And what the framers wanted was a situation where we had these two different spheres. Government kept out of religion, but again, religion was not supposed to influence public policy.
You write about Madison introducing the proposed Bill of Rights in the House of Representatives in 1789. And, of course, we're familiar with the phrase, Congress shall make no law establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. You write about that his proposed amendments included one that specified, quote, the civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established. Why does that language and sort of that that evolution of language that we see there matter to you?
It matters to follow, I think, the entire evolution of language, both in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Because one of the arguments, for example, that has been made, in fact, by some Supreme Court justices, is that what the Establishment Clause only prohibits is preference among religions. A government can still, in some way, support religion in general, even if that has some kind of prejudicial effect on non-believers. But if you look at the evolution of the language in the House and the Senate, there was actually a proposal along those lines, namely that the Establishment Clause essentially said there would be no preference among different religions, no national sect would be established. That language was rejected. So the argument that somehow the non-preferentialist interpretation is correct simply doesn't square with the history. It's like saying that if a contract was proposed and rejected, that contract language still governs. It simply makes no sense. At the end of the day, what they wound up with is a very broad separation of religion and government, saying that there should be no law respecting establishment of religion in general.
Let's get back to the phones. This is I think this is Shauna in Rochester. Is this Jack? This is Herman. It's one of the three.
This is Herman.
Hi, Herman.
Okay.
I apologize. This is Herman in Brighton. Go ahead.
On the one hand, I just wanted to explain that from a purely religious point of view, there is a logic and a rationale to the idea that that somebody taking an oath, whether this be for taking office or for testifying, would need to be somebody that believes in a higher power. And if you look at it historically, because the original nature of an oath was a self-imprecation, basically saying, if I break this oath, the participant saying, if I break this oath, may some horrible fate befall me. For example, we have, even as far back as the Bible, we have examples of the participants in an oath dividing an animal in two and walking through between the pieces of the animal as if to say, may I become like this animal if I break this oath. And of course, the enforcer of the oath would be the deity that is invoked, and that becomes the protector of that oath and enforces the punishment. So that is the logic from a religious point of view. Of course, what fundamentalists need to understand if they live in the United States of America is that we live in a pluralistic society where there are a variety of religions and people who have no religion at all, and they all have equal rights to practice their religion or to not practice a religion, and we live under a constitution that guarantees freedom of religion and has a separation of church and state. So, you know, a religious person should be totally free to practice their religion in their home, in the church, in their religious school, in a gathering of like-minded, like-believing people, you know, teach and practice it with their families and their children, but no one has any right to impose their religious beliefs, their religious law, their religious views on others in the United States of America.
Herman, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Quick reaction, Dan?
Sure. I understand that many people believe that when they take an oath, the enforcer, as he put it, of the oath is the deity. When I make an oath, because I don't believe that there is a deity, when I make an oath, I make it to another person. If I take an oath to my country, for example, I'm making an oath to the other people of the country, the citizens of America, are the enforcers of that oath. So it's a simple difference as to, quote, who is the enforcer of the oath. But I think when any of us makes a promise or an oath, we're making it to at least a large extent to each other, and I think that's very important.
I think this is Shauna in Rochester. Is this Shauna?
Hi. I would like to say that I'm very pleased that although the town of Greece won in court not too long ago, the right to continue with their, shall I say, exclusivist Christian practices, that they have chosen not to do so. I think that's progress, and I'm glad that we don't have to have a court order a town council to do the right thing. Having said that, I am a fervent believer in the Christian God. I'm an Episcopalian. And I'd like to say that my view of religion and most of the people that I know do not have a slavish connection to a particular scripture, nor do we do the right thing because, quote, somebody is watching us, unquote. I believe that's almost an exact quote from one of your earlier callers. The chief advantage of religion, as far as I'm concerned, is that it teaches one patience and teaches one a great many things. If you have a difficult situation that you need to wait in or where the outcome is uncertain, and I do not believe that quoting a line of scripture will shut off the conversation. For example, if I say that the second commandment is love thy neighbor as thyself, well then, what is the loving thing to do about physician-assisted dying? That is still a very much debatable thing.
Yeah, Sean, I think those are all...
I mean, it's not slavery to as if human beings are little automatons, and we are programmed to do a certain thing and behave in a certain way because our God dictates it.
Yeah, I think to Shauna's point, she's absolutely right in that people believe for different reasons or for different bases. We were sort of talking about the people who do openly express, "Hey, it's if there is no God, what's the harm in going to church?" That's very different than what Shauna's belief is. It's very different than what a lot of people say. Now, Dan, she's making points about what her religion brings to her.
Sure.
What were your thoughts hearing that?
Well, the original part, first part of her question or statement was that she was supportive of the idea of me giving the invocation tonight, and I really appreciate that. It's really important that believers show their support. But my question is, this practice has been going on for about 15 years in the town of Greece, and tonight will be the first non-theistic invocation. I hope that after tonight there will be more opportunities for non-believers to provide invocations. I think we have some catching up to do, and it will be people like Shauna that will hold the town board's feet to the fire when it comes to being inclusive.
That's well said. Jack and Webster. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, I just have an interesting anecdote for you. I lived in a small town in the mid-80s for about a year and joined the Unitarian Church. And it was such a small town that there was no pastor for the church. Each month, a different member of the congregation took over as the director of things. And in December, the guy whose turn it was happened to be an atheist. So I went to Christmas morning service led by an atheist. And it was great. that's my story.
Thanks, Jack. I mean, there's plenty of atheists who celebrate Christmas as a secular holiday, right? There's,
sure, I do.
Sure, I do. Yeah.
I'm looking at two, apparently, right now. One more quick call. Ron, we have to keep it as tight as we can. Go ahead, Ron.
My question my statement is very brief in that I'm very supportive in what your guest is doing and what the Webster Town Board is doing by offering him the opportunity. But my question is this. Is not the fact that the invocation is being held or observed in the first place an observation of religion to begin with? Madison said in the First Amendment, who wrote the First Amendment, no religious trust shall ever be required as qualification to any office or public trust. And he himself was against the establishment of a chaplain to Congress. He claimed that it was a violation of equal rights as well as constitutional principles.
Yeah, Ron, let me jump in here real briefly and say that Justice Kennedy, who I believe wrote the majority opinion,
that's correct,
in this case, indicated that there is a long tradition in this country of what he views as sort of benign prayer that is largely inclusive, et cetera. So I think they do acknowledge that, yes, that's prayer at the start of a meeting, but Justice Kennedy says that's part of the fabric of this country. Is that roughly correct?
That's a fair interpretation of his opinion, yes.
Okay. Let me close with this since we've got less than a minute left here. Dan, do you feel any pressure tonight to, if this is the one shot atheists have to give an invocation, did you feel pressure for tonight?
A little bit of pressure. I mostly feel honored that folks like Ron Lindsay have come here to help support me in this effort. A number of other secular organizations have come as well. And as some of these callers have expressed, their support for inclusion in the process. So I'm very, very honored and humbled by their appreciation.
And Ron, about 20 seconds. What do you see coming out of this case going forward? And what would your take be sort of in the aftermath of this case?
What I would hope is that this would set a precedent. In other words, that municipalities and town councils would be more inclusive and make sure that all Americans are represented.
Dan, you feel welcome tonight, don't you?
Yes.
There's no question that Dan Courtney, an atheist, feels welcome tonight at the town of Greece. And as he said, he hopes that continues, but he's feeling that from the town of Greece. We'll see how things go going forward. Tonight, 6 o'clock at the Greece Town Hall. And Ron Lindsay from the Center for Inquiry, thank you for taking the time to be here.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we'll look for his book, The Necessity of Secularism, later this year. Dan Courtney, thanks for taking the time as well. And I'm sure it's a busy afternoon for you.
It's been a quite busy day, yes.
I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to all the callers and interacting. Dave Campo behind the glass, our engineer. And thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.